You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Senate last week overwhelmingly passed President Trump's signature trade deal with Mexico and Canada, and it helped him fulfill a 2016 campaign promise. So we're looking at what the USMCA will do as the president is expected to sign it into law this week. Are you a farmer looking to sell products overseas? What does the replacement to NAFTA mean for your business, your industry? We're at 800-642-1234. Lori Wallach is director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. She's a 25-year veteran of the country's congressional trade battles, beginning with the NAFTA fight in the 90s. And she's been called a trade deal whisperer for her ability to explain the complexities of trade agreements. Lori, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Well, give us some context here. President Trump has called the USMCA the best and most important trade deal ever for our country. What are the biggest changes you see in this trade deal from NAFTA?
Well, I think folks won't find it shocking that the president's exaggerating a little bit. There are important changes, but it's not a total replacement of NAFTA. The big improvements are that there was eliminated from NAFTA the outrageous investor-state dispute settlement system. Those are those corporate tribunals where companies can go to three private lawyers and demand unlimited compensation from taxpayers if they think that some domestic environmental or health law or government action or court ruling undermined their new NAFTA privileges. And $400 million has been paid out during NAFTA in corporate attacks and environmental laws, health laws, energy policies. So that is totally eliminated between the U.S. and Canada and whacked way back with Mexico. And that's a big improvement for the environment. And also parts of those investor rules promoted job outsourcing by making it cheaper and easier to relocate to Mexico. So that's an improvement. There are stronger labor standards in the agreement and a new enforcement tool that
What do you mean by
used.
Stronger labor, looking at labor, what do you see there?
So the backstory of this is the president signed a deal in 2018, the NAFTA 2.0, that wouldn't have made things better, that wouldn't have stopped job outsourcing, and that shockingly actually added new goodies for big pharma, new monopoly rights that would have locked in our high medicine prices. So folks probably remember watching anxiously for the year while the Democrats said, we're not going to put that up for a vote. Democrats have a majority in the House. And there was a big fight. And one of the issues was the Democrats were insisting that the labor standards in the deal Trump signed in 2018 were basically improved by adding new requirements for Mexico to allow real unions. In Mexico, there are what are called protection unions. Companies that call themselves unions get paid by the boss to create a contract before the first worker is even hired. Usually, the workers don't vote on their union contract, and that gets registered in Mexico City, and then, ooh, the company's complying with the law, there's a union. And those fake unions, their job is to protect the boss and keep wages low. So in Mexico now, wages are lower in real terms than when NAFTA was enacted in 1994, and 40% lower than, if you can imagine, in China. So $2 a day for, you know, brand name U.S. companies. And so the rules in the agreement require that within 4 years, Mexico replace all those fake unions with real unions.
We're talking with Lori Wallach. She's director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. We're looking at the pieces of the USMCA, the new North American trade deal that it's been approved by Congress with bipartisan support. Join in 800-642-1234. Lori, let's zoom in on what this trade deal means for dairy products and Wisconsin's relationship with Canada. What differences might farmers in Wisconsin notice under the new agreement?
It's not going to be a big deal. And the main reason why is NAFTA, the original NAFTA in 1994, eliminated all tariffs between the U.S. and Mexico, so 100% market access, and most tariffs with Canada. And one of the few areas where there wasn't totally duty-free trade and total market access was dairy. And the way that that was done is a certain percentage of imports were duty-free. That's called a tariff rate quota, but the rest of it had a tariff. So the tariff rate quota, the amount of dairy products that's duty-free, was expanded slightly with respect to Canada. But to put this in perspective, the United States exports, you know, more than $10 billion of agricultural products to Canada every year. And the total national increase in dairy exports is around 200 million. So it's kind of a drop in the bucket, so to speak. And especially after the implications of the China counter tariffs, which have reduced Wisconsin's exports to China 22% just last year, nationwide $15 billion decrease in ag exports to China. So the Canada increase is not going to make a huge difference, but it's you know, it could help a little on the margins.
These changes are supposed to be phased in over time, over years. How long will it take before we start to see the effects of this agreement?
That's a really good question. So the good news is the original deal that Trump had signed in 2018 had some very bad things that went to effect right away, including the new goodies for Big Pharma that would have immediately basically knocked off of Congress's agenda a bunch of improvements that are now being fought over to try and bring down prices for drugs in the U.S. by increasing competition. So that got knocked out. That would have been something bad right away. But on the other hand, some of the things that market access to Canada, for instance, that's right away. So if there's going to be an improvement, that's right away. But some of the things that would make the biggest difference for working people, that's going to be slow. I mean, a thing everyone needs to understand is this agreement is not going to bring back hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs. The government has certified 1 million U.S. jobs lost to NAFTA, and that's just under one narrow program. It's hard to qualify for, so it's an undercount. In that system called Trade Adjustment Assistance, there are 83,000 Wisconsin jobs certified as lost to trade. The top five NAFTA job losses, Briggs & Stratton in Wisconsin, Briggs & Stratton, Honeywell, Masterlock, NewPage. And those jobs, the way this agreement is written, those jobs are not coming back. If it works, over time, workers in Mexico will be able to fight for higher wages. Folks in those U.S. firms make $2 an hour doing the exact same job that someone in Wisconsin got paid $15, $20, $25 an hour to make. This is not a Wisconsin example, but Goodyear, the tire company, many of us have Goodyear tires in our cars. They closed down plants in the U.S. where their workers were making between $22 and $25 an hour. And their workers in San Luis Potosí, in a brand new plant, multi-hundreds of millions of dollars, fancy, fancy plant, get paid $1.88 an hour. Mm. So the wages there are ridiculously low.
Lori, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lori Wallach is Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. We've been talking about the USMCA, the replacement to NAFTA. Up next, a Wisconsin alum explains his new adventure on the Discovery Channel, examining and reviving dormant gold mines. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about a new reality show on the Discovery Channel that's co-hosted by a UW alumnus. It's called Reclaimed, and it's about the work of reviving old, deserted, dormant gold mines. Here's a bit of the trailer.
There's a secret to owning some of America's most valuable land.
Wow, is it cool up here?
They're called mining claims.
Look at this place. Holy smoking, Joe.
Often bought for pennies.
$5,000 for the whole claim?
Yep. they can be worth much more.
We have an inferred value of over $2 billion.
Have you ever wanted to try gold mining or pan for gold? Maybe you worked in a precious metal mining operation. What was that like? We're at 800-642-1234. Alex Charvet is co-host of Reclaimed on the Discovery Channel. He's a UW-Madison alum with a baccalaureate degree in forest science, master's in biological systems engineering. And this isn't his first foray into TV. He was a contestant on Top Shoot. That's a shooting competition reality show. Alex, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate.
Well, take us to these deserted mines. Where are they? What do they look like?
The mines are all over Colorado, and well, they're actually all over the Rocky Mountains, and including California. I think everybody's familiar with the gold rush of 1849. In fact, they're probably overly familiar with it right now because the 49ers just beat the Packers, and they got their name from the gold rush. So, unfortunately, we are connotating gold right now with a bad instance. But I mean, that's the situation. Gold was found out west in it's the Rocky Mountains. I mean, the Earth's crust came up and exposed a bunch of veins, and people said, hey, look, there's gold there, and started mining it. So we're going to these old claims and, in essence, reclaiming them. But it's not the actual hard rock mining most people think of. We're generally dealing with the tailings.
Now, what does that mean?
The tailings are what's left over. It's kind of like in home state, the Badger State there, a badger digs a hole and there's a bunch of dirt that comes out of the ground and a little pile next to the hole, and we call that tailings in mining. and that's what it is here. I mean, these miners went in the mountains and they dug into the ground and, you know, kind of spit out all the bad rock right in front of the hole. And that bad rock, well, back then wasn't very valuable, today is. I mean, there was a cost of getting the gold from the mine to the mill and getting that processed. And there was a threshold. I mean, it still exists in business today. You know, what's profitable? And that profit point has changed. So today, what wasn't valuable then is now. So, I mean, gold's at $1,600 an ounce, or pretty close to that. I think it was like $1,570, I don't know. But it's a lot more than it was back then. Back then, it was about $20 an ounce.
I imagine your equipment has changed a lot since the gold rush in the 1800s.
Exactly. I mean, that's the other thing that's in our favor right now. I mean, we have bulldozers, we have, you know, diesel machinery, jackhammers, a lot of stuff that we didn't have back then. Excavators, I mean, that didn't exist then. It was dynamite, a pickaxe, a shovel, and a donkey, and that's how you transported, you know, ore from place to place. And everybody thinks you just go in the mountain and you, like, hack away, and all of a sudden there's, like, these big gold chunks that come out and you're rich. But most of the time that gold had to be processed, and that went through a mill, it was refined, and then they took the gold out of the rock. And we're much more efficient at that today than we were back then.
We're talking with Alex Charvet. He's co-host of Reclaimed. It's a new reality TV series that airs on the Discovery Channel. Alex, how did you get involved with this series on the Discovery Channel? How did this show come about?
This is a long story, and I'll try to make it as short as I can. So back in 2011, I applied for a shooting show on TV. It was History Channel. It was called Top Shot. And we used live firearms, and it was a competition. And I did that in 2011, did well, then went back in 2013 for, it was called Top Shot All-Stars. They took the best back for another competition. And through that process, I just enjoyed it. I loved the camera aspect of it. And it wasn't the money. There's very little money in it, by the way. I mean, there's the fame. Occasionally I get recognized. That's not it either. But it's sharing this story. It's this passion that you're, like, telling somebody else. It's like writing a book, but the book is in 3D. It's live, and you're sharing that with an audience, and I love that part of it. So I just stayed in touch, and this is very difficult, but the networking, I call it Hollywood, but it's not really Hollywood. These producers just kept, you know, staying in touch, asking what's going on, applying for different auditions, just talking to them. And there's a local one in Denver. It's called Dorsey Pictures, and one of the representatives there said, hey, we have an idea about some log cabins. We're looking for an expert. And I said, I am the expert.
You build log cabins.
Yes. I'm like, that's me. So that sort of stopped there. We pitched a show, and that show was called Cabin Rescue, and that aired in 2016, I think. And it didn't get picked up. It was on a playoff night, and we didn't have any luck. Our ratings were okay, but not good enough. And at the time, Discovery was buying HG and a bunch of other networks, and it just wasn't a good time, and me being, you know, part of that group, along with Dorsey, the producers, kind of morphed that show, and we're like, well, what if we fixed up cabins on mining claims where there was gold? Because Discovery sort of, I don't want to call it secret ingredient, it's obvious, one of their keys to their shows is gold, and we threw that in there because it's right in our backyard, and we got greenlit this spring, and that means we got the go. So it's been nine years in the coming to make this happen.
Well, let's take a call now. Lucy in Madison is with us. Good morning, Lucy.
Hi.
Hi, Lucy.
My question is about, I'm aware that for gold mining, they use a cyanide chemical, which is extremely poisonous. And then I've seen, you know, like where they have mines, they have like a, I don't know what you call it, a pond where they put their cyanide chemicals.
Sure,
you know,
a tailings pond.
Be lined. So how do you deal with that? You know, if you have a bunch of small mines developing, and how are the people going to deal with that? Because that's a dangerous chemical, and it can cause, you know, it can get loose into the environment. So how do they deal with that?
Yeah, cyanide's incredibly dangerous. We don't use cyanide anymore. Well, not at this level. What we're doing is we're taking the tailings, which are the leftovers, like I explained. We're bringing those to a local mill. And the local mill is highly regulated. It's incredible. I mean, almost unfathomable the amount of rules and regulations these guys have to follow. But those tailings go through a mill, and for the most part, they're sorted physically, not chemically. So the rock, these tailings are crushed, and they're sorted gravimetrically, and we're dividing them by weight, in essence, through some sort of sluice box. I mean, that's the common term, but it's on a much larger scale. And we're separating the ore in that manner. So we're not using chemicals. There is some chemical refining that is done, but it's highly regulated, and it's not done on site. So it's a different... I mean, we're not digging holes in the ground and using cyanide out in the woods. I mean, that's not happening. And if somebody is doing that, it's highly regulated.
Yeah, Alex, what goes into the day-to-day activity of shooting this and working in these mines? Because to me, it would be like each mine is different. Each episode then would be quite different from one to the next.
It is. And the cool thing about our business sort of plan with this situation is we're not actually doing the mining. Kevin and I, Kevin's the other host, he's actually my best friend in real life. We're not doing the mining. We're not swinging a pick. We're not shoveling ore. What we're doing is we're going to these sort of cash-strapped miners, and I don't mean it negatively. It's just a lot of people have this dream and say, I really want to do this, and I bought this claim, and they can get them for almost pennies on the dollar, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And they pick them up, and they're like, well, there's gold in the hill, and there is, but they can't get it out. So we basically finance their startup and sort of give them a kickstart to get them going. And they actually do the processing and all that, and we're just taking a part of it. So like you said, in terms of the filming, it is varied. But I think that's what brings life to this show, because it's not the same thing over and over. The premise is the same, but the picture when we're done is different every single time.
How dangerous is this work?
It's not that bad. It really isn't. We're not in the mines, and there's MSHA. MSHA is like sort of our mining safety. It's basically the OSHA of mining. I mean, we always have representatives there working with us on the safety aspect of it. In terms of safety, our biggest threat is probably getting to and from the mine, and in a lot of cases, that is very difficult to do.
So that creates some drama, some tension. You need tension in this reality show there, Alex.
Yes. So yes. I mean, we've used everything from horses, dirt bikes, ATVs, helicopters, off-road jeeps. I mean, our feet. I mean, accessibility is one of the reasons why these things are relatively inexpensive.
Because helicopters?
Yes. You just can't get to them.
So are there any more reality shows up your sleeves? What should we know about your next project?
Right now, I'm just hoping for season two. I'm having a blast with this. I mean, it's literally a dream come true. So I'm not looking beyond this right now. I'm just hoping that our viewers like it. And, you know, we're just sharing very passionately. And, you know, it's reality TV in the sense that it is us. There's no, we're not doctoring anything up. And I hope that comes through to the audience and it's liked.
As we wrap up here, when you meet the people who own these claims, and some are really destitute, what is that like?
The meeting the claim owners is really interesting, because we've run the gamut, you know, from literally dirt poor to very wealthy businessmen who are, you know, investing in these claims. And it's all, you know, the spectrum covers that entire area. And it's, you never know what you're going to get. You just don't. I mean, some of these people are like, this is my dream. They've literally laid down all of their cash to make this happen. And these other people, you know, on the investor standpoint, the much higher level, are like, all right, here's a business proposition. If you guys can do X, Y, and Z, we can get going with this. So that part is really interesting, and the people are amazing, just good-hearted people.
Alex, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely, Kate. Thank you for having me on.
Alex Charvet is co-host of the Discovery Channel reality TV series Reclaimed. It airs Thursdays at 8 Central. Coming up, Facebook has been under pressure from Congress to change its hands-off rules for political ads. Do you use Facebook? How do you feel about the way the platform approaches political advertising? Join in 800-642-1234. We look at Facebook ad policies in an election year right after this news update on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at Facebook's ad policies on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The social media's hands-off approach to political ads is running contrary to other large tech firms in this presidential election year. So Facebook's policies have allowed for some misleading ads. In October, there was one ad from the Trump campaign that made false accusations about Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden. That ad went viral. It was viewed by millions of people. Do you think politicians should be allowed to tell mistruths in ads on social media? Is this a free speech issue, in your opinion? Political campaigns are allowed by law to tell them in TV ads. Do you think the same should hold true for social media? We're at 800-642-1234. Stephen Overly is a technology reporter for Politico. He covers the tech industry's influence in Washington, and he contributes to Politico's Morning Tech Report. Stephen, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So earlier this month, we learned Facebook said, basically, we're going to keep on keeping on showing political campaigns that use targeted advertising that Facebook won't fact check their ads. What is the significance of those decisions?
So they'll be very significant because Facebook is expected to be the dominant online advertising platform for political campaigns. And we're already seeing political campaigns spend millions of dollars to sort of get their message out to Facebook users and potential voters who use the social network. So really the company's decision here was going to have a lot of consequence. And you saw that in the lead up with political campaigns and political parties putting a lot of pressure on Facebook, really not to change its policy, especially when it comes to targeting political ads and essentially determining how it is that political campaigns reach potential voters online.
So when we say political ads here, what does that entail? Is this just ads from political campaigns or is this larger?
So that is the lion's share in sort of defining exactly what constitutes a political ad is different, or has been difficult. By and large, the platforms like Twitter, Facebook, Google differentiate between political ads, which is something that might come from a political campaign or a political party, and what they've called issues ads, which target or deal with political issues, say gun control, for example, or climate change. And really, the companies have handled those ads differently, in part because one of the, you know, political ads tend to come from elected officials or want to be elected officials, and therefore should be handled in a different way. At least that's how the companies have viewed it.
So why are targeted political ads and maybe this micro-targeting of certain populations, why is that a concern?
So micro-targeting of political ads allows campaigns to reach voters, or I guess internet users, but potential voters on a very granular level. And one of the issues there is therefore you're having kind of individual messages sent to small groups of people. And there's less ability for fact checking of those ads, less ability to open up public debate if something in those ads is maybe misleading. And so therefore you're able to in some ways kind of manipulate or skew the online political discourse. And so that's the concern, that campaigns have been sort of using this micro-targeting to exploit that fact that these social media platforms, though they are very broad, actually allow you to reach a very narrow audience.
In 2016, this was a concern, too, with spreading misinformation, political misinformation.
That's exactly right. Political ads were one of several ways that misinformation was spread during the 2016 election. And so, you know, to their credit, some of these tech platforms really did take a lesson from that, and they've created online databases where political advertisements are listed. You know, the groups behind those advertisements are listed. Information about how those ads are targeted is listed. And the idea here is to really make this whole process more transparent, allow people like you or I to go online and really see who is behind political advertising. Now, that doesn't do away with the political advertising, of course. It's still very much part of our feeds online, but at least there's more transparency around them. That's been the approach that really all of the tech platforms have taken. You know, one area where they've differentiated since then is the degree to which they allow political advertising and the degree to which they allow this micro-targeting.
Right, because Twitter is kind of washing its hands of political ads.
That's right. So, you know, it's interesting. If you look at Facebook, you look at Google, and you look at Twitter, each company has taken a slightly different approach here. And so it'll be kind of fascinating to watch throughout the 2020 election cycle the consequences of each of those decisions. But as you said, Twitter has said that they're getting rid of all political advertising on their platform. Now, that's an easier call perhaps for Twitter to make. They were the smallest of the platforms when it came to political advertising. But nevertheless, you know, they've sort of staken out this position that you should not be able to buy access to their network if you're a politician trying to get out your message, that any kind of amplification of your message on social media should be earned. Google has taken a slightly less restrictive approach in that they have limited micro-targeting. If you want to run a political ad on Google today, you can limit based on factors like age and gender and geographic location, but anything more granular than that has been prohibited. And again, the idea there is to sort of make sure that ads are reaching larger audiences and that they're subject to kind of more online debate. And then finally, the most permissive policy is, of course, Facebook, which recently said they will continue to allow micro-targeting. They will not fact-check political ads. And instead, they're just sort of increasing their efforts to make those ads more transparent.
We're talking with Stephen Overly. He's a tech reporter at Politico, and we're talking about political ads on Facebook and the policies behind not policing their truthfulness. Do you use Facebook? How do you feel about the way the platform approaches political advertising? Do you agree with how other platforms like Twitter handle this issue? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Stephen, I was looking yesterday at the 2020 candidates, presidential candidates, and their digital spending. Just astounded to see the millions of dollars led by President Trump's campaign combined Facebook and Google buying about $35 million. So there's a lot of money at stake here.
That's absolutely right. You know, a lot of projections put digital advertising spending alone in this election cycle over $1 billion. So there's a lot of money at stake here. And, you know, I think as we all know, we're spending more time online. We're spending more time using these social networks. And therefore, in each election cycle, they've become a more important piece of campaign's advertising strategy. They are a more important platform for reaching potential voters, convincing them to support you. You know, at the same time, they're also have opened up a new frontier in, you know, political manipulation. You know, the reality is, as I had one person say to me while covering this whole debate, you know, politicians have been telling, you know, mistruths since the dawn of politics. What's different now is that they can magnify that on the internet. They can reach such a large audience on the internet. And so, you know, the consequences of kind of misleading advertising are that much greater due to the size of this audience.
Explain for us the parallel here or contrast between what you can do on this medium, on social media platforms, versus what you can say and put out there for TV advertising.
Well, one of the big differences is this micro-targeting that we've talked about. You know, when you run a television ad, you can target it to a specific geographic market. You can perhaps put it next to certain programming. So perhaps if you want to reach women voters or you want to reach older voters, perhaps you'll pair your advertisement with a program that targets or reaches that demographic. With political digital advertising, you can get so much more granular than that. Beyond just age or gender, you can target people based on their interests. You can get insight into their political leanings based on, you know, what they've posted or their activity online. You can target certain groups of people at a very granular level and sort of, you know, speak to maybe their specific political interests or the issues that you know are likely to get them the most kind of agitated or inspired to vote. So that's one of the key differences. And you've seen campaigns really go full into digital advertising because they've gotten much smarter about using that data to really reach people who they think will support their candidate. So that's one of the big factors at play. You know, you're also just moving vast volumes of advertising across these platforms. You know, Facebook and Google and Twitter, a lot of their advertising process is automated. And so it really allows you to put ads out there much more quickly and frankly, much more cheaply. And therefore, you can see a greater number of political ads and different types of political ads, perhaps to test out, you know, how your message might resonate when it's delivered in different ways.
Where does Congress stand on these policies from Facebook?
So we've seen a lot of political pressure on Facebook as well as the other internet platforms for how they handle digital advertising. Obviously, every member of Congress is using Facebook to reach their constituents and to reach potential voters the next time they seek re-election. So, you know, this is an issue that directly affects all those decision makers. We've seen some discussion of potential legislation on this issue, but nothing has moved. And the reality is it gets into a very sticky issue of First Amendment free speech rights. You know, any sort of regulation of political advertising will certainly come up against arguments that it violates the First Amendment and violates this long-held principle in our country that the federal government or government in general should not be dictating speech. And so while you've seen a lot of rhetoric in Congress, you've seen a lot of pressure from members of Congress on these companies, you have not seen a lot of momentum behind any legislative proposals for how to deal with this issue.
Talking with Politico technology reporter Stephen Overly about the policies of Facebook, Twitter, Google on political ads. Facebook's ad archive shows President Trump's campaign has spent about $20 million on ads on that particular social media platform. So as you scroll through your Facebook feed and see ads, what do you notice about them? What stands out to you? What do you think would create more transparency around political ads you see on social media? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Politico's Stephen Overly on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking about Facebook. The company has come under scrutiny for its policy of not removing political ads that contain misinformation. And Facebook recently announced steps to give users more control over the ads that they see. But they did not back down on policing ads that spread false information. Do you think Congress should be involved in regulating what tech companies can post by their advertisers? Or do you think it should be up to the companies to figure out their own policies? Join in, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Stephen Overly covers tech for Politico, and he stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Nate is in Milwaukee this morning. Hi, Nate.
Hi, thank you for having me. This discussion actually reminded me of a couple of years ago when I remember that reading that conservative groups were criticizing Facebook and pressuring Zuckerberg and eventually did meet with him. And I wonder if they were basically pushing him to let them lie to people they figured would be most susceptible to a given lie online, and at some point he caved. I think it was actually a great idea to potentially allow the lie to go through, but also add some sort of marker to it that says a fact checker looked at this and says it wrong. So you're allowing them to speak, but also pointing out that they're not speaking the truth.
Nate,
the transparent.
Yeah, go Nate, ahead. I want to pause right there and see from you, Stephen, where is Facebook's founder Mark Zuckerberg in all of this?
Absolutely. So Nate raises an interesting point, which is that for a couple of years now, we've heard from conservatives this argument that social media platforms, including Facebook and Twitter, are sort of censoring conservative voices. President Trump has sort of championed that cause quite a big way. And so as a result, Facebook and specifically Mark Zuckerberg have certainly engaged more with conservative politicians and conservative advocates. And it has been reported that Mark Zuckerberg has met with some of those conservative leaders, as was mentioned. You know, Facebook has really, and Mark Zuckerberg specifically, have really sort of said that free the argument behind making political ads more permissive is free speech, that people deserve to hear directly from politicians what it is they're thinking and what policies they're promoting, and then make a decision for themselves what is trustworthy and what is fact and what is fiction. That's not a decision the company should be making. So that's really the line that Mark Zuckerberg has stuck to when defending kind of this very permissive advertising policy on his social network.
Nate, thanks. Let's go to Brian now in Madison. Hi, Brian.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like the guest to comment on the definition of political advertising. What we saw in Cambridge, the Cambridge Analytics, was their use of an outrage cycle of micro-targeting certain messages to provoke political response and to basically groom political thought. Is there any comment on what actually constitutes advertising?
Brian, thanks. And Cambridge Analytica, they had harvested the personal data of millions of people's Facebook profiles without their consent. Stephen?
Absolutely. So this definition of political advertising has been a tricky one because there's not a textbook definition. It's something the companies themselves have had to define. And on the one hand, sort of, you know, the narrow definition is advertisements from political campaigns and candidates. And that's certainly true pretty much across the platforms. Where it gets murky is this question of issue-based advertising. And as was mentioned in the Cambridge Analytica case, and really by, you know, in election meddling more broadly in 2016, a lot of the ads were actually based on issues. You know, they tried to exploit different points of view and sort of discord around issues like race and religion, as well as political issues like climate change, abortion, gun control. And so, you know, sure, we can discuss political advertising, but really when you look at the broader scope of kind of how we talk about politics online, candidates and campaigns are just one piece of that. And really there is this broader sort of online discourse around some of these social differences. And those can be even more emotional and perhaps more ripe for exploitation than even our discussion around political campaigns.
We're talking with Stephen Overly, a tech reporter at Politico, and he's been following Facebook in this election year. And the social media platform has been under pressure to change its hands-off rules for political ads. Stephen, some are concerned that these targeted political ads aren't the real concern, that there is a bigger threat to democracy in organic, unpaid content. What is that domain like?
Absolutely. So political advertising and sort of this question about misleading political ads is just one piece of broader concerns about misinformation around our elections. You know, after the 2016 election, we learned, for instance, that Russian trolls had been meddling in our online political discourse, trying to sway political points of view and trying to influence essentially the election's outcome. And really in this 2020 election cycle, you know, the threats may be even more advanced and even harder to detect. So for instance, you know, some of the tactics we saw from Russian trolls in the 2016 election are tactics we could see from Americans trying to influence the 2020 election. And that includes what you refer to being organic posts. And these are posts from regular users of Facebook and Twitter and YouTube that maybe contain inaccuracies or contain deliberate misleading content. So one prime example that we've probably all seen online are memes, you know, these sort of pictures that sort of convey a point of view, and sometimes they're, you know, a little bit cheeky or a little bit flippant. Sometimes they're quite serious, and they can spread very quickly online. They're not always accurate, and they certainly lack a lot of context. And so these are just some of the ways that, you know, the information that we all see online can be manipulated. And therefore, you know, we as internet users have to be kind of savvy about what it is we're believing and sort of vetting that for ourselves, especially if these platforms are not going to vet it for us.
So we're months away from the 2020 election now. What do you see will change or not change in the future on these social media platforms?
I think you'll certainly continue to see pressure on these social media platforms to respond to inaccuracies and, you know, misinformation that's spread across them. You know, that could certainly be in the form of political advertising, although now that the major platforms have all sort of staked out their position, it would be surprising to see them make changes to them. You know, they've deliberated about these decisions for many months before making them. And so it's likely they'll stick with them at least through this election cycle and perhaps reevaluate after 2020. But, you know, every media organization, every political campaign, and every sort of watchdog will be on high alert to look for, you know, targeted misinformation campaigns around the 2020 election.
Are watchdogs concerned about Russian interference in 2020?
Certainly there's concern about Russian interference and foreign interference. But, you know, some of the concern is also around, domestic interference, if that's what you want to call it. You know, certainly it's, you know, illegal for foreign nationals to try to influence a U.S. election. It is not illegal for Americans to try to influence a U.S. election, right? In fact, that's quite encouraged to participate in democracy. But, you know, there is this question of when those contributions are deliberately misleading or deliberately manipulative, you know, how do you rein those in? How do you try to account for those? And that's a question that we're going to be grappling with over the next several months and even beyond November.
Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Stephen Overly is a technology reporter for Politico. He covers the tech industry's influence in Washington and contributes to Politico's Morning Tech Report. Just ahead, we look at a new biography about Gwen Jorgensen, a Wisconsin triathlete who made it to the Olympics and won the gold in Rio in 2016. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.